Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to this podcast this afternoon. In today's segment, we'll be talking with Mr. Brad Rhodes. He's the head of cybersecurity, a company of a leading web content categorization firm known as Zvelo. They're based in Greenwood Village, Colorado. Brad, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Sure, absolutely.
First question I want to ask you out of the gate, Brad, what exactly is web content categorization? Can you clarify that for our audience?
Sure,
are we talking like SEO stuff or like Google rankings, or what are we talking about here?
So not really. So Zvelo, when it comes to web content categorization, what we're looking to do is kind of the reverse of Google. That's a good analogy there. So when you go to like the Google search engine, you type in words and you get information, content, et cetera. When you come to our website at Zvelo, you type in a URL and you get an assessment of the content, right? And so basically what we're doing is we're working to categorize the web so that we can help to protect our customers from objectionable content, malicious content, but then also many of our customers use that to protect their brands, right? So that's really what we do when it comes to web content categorization.
Gotcha. Okay, gotcha. Because I think I had a podcast with actually another guest last week, and they were talking about using bots. And for like some kind of something similar. So it's interesting that we have this podcast. It kind of correlates well with the one from last week. But anyway, well, we looked up your bio, and you seem to have a very deep, rich background in cybersecurity. And we looked you up on LinkedIn, Google search. Don't worry, we didn't do like a background search or anything on you. But can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and like what got you started in cybersecurity? What piqued your interest?
It's a wild and crazy tale. I started out when I graduated from college as an Army signal officer in the United States Army.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what in the back of the day we used to call communications, right? It's still called signal today. It sort of goes back to the era of the Civil War and everything like that, flags, that kind of stuff, semaphore, really interesting stuff. And so I actually have been tinkering and mucking around in security and stuff like that since I was a kid. I always joke with my kid, I had a trash 80 growing up. I probably did war dialing back in the day. I did, and did lots of experimenting and taught myself how to code and then did that in college and then did sort of fledgling cybersecurity type stuff before it was even called that when I was in the Army. And then when I got off of active duty, I joined the Colorado Army National Guard and have done a number of deployments, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom. Most recently, I was actually deployed for a cyber mission out at Fort Meade, Maryland, and that's a pretty big highlight. We had a lot of interesting times out there doing the nation's work from a cyber perspective. I did a lot of government contracting, worked in the intelligence community at one point or another, but always sort of came back to the idea of doing cybersecurity. It was always something that was a hobby of mine. I always tinkered with technology, always did that kind of work, and eventually came back to it full-time about 5 years ago and got into some of the things. A big highlight for me was when we had the Colorado Department of Transportation CDOT response to the SAMSAM ransomware in 2018. And we took a portion of my cybersecurity team from the National Guard, and we actually helped to recover from that particular incident. So definitely wide and varied and interesting. But again, I like to think of myself as a cybersecurity technologist, always trying to get the latest, greatest stuff, trying to break stuff, trying to learn new things, trying to grow the craft. And along the way, I teach others. I'm an affiliate professor at Regis University, where I teach ethical hacking, policy type stuff, incident response, all sorts of things. So I'm pretty well connected, plugged in, do all sorts of interesting things. And now I'm at Zvelo, which is really awesome. It's a great company, and we're really excited with the path we're taking out as we move down the road.
Excellent. Well, two things here. I just want to tell you thank you so much for your military service. You know, it's an honor to have you on the show like that. Thank you again, once again, for your service. And two, you talked about the TRS-80s. That's how I got started too in my kick on computers. I remember you had to upload code, I think, from actually a cassette tape, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes,
and,
sir.
Yeah. And I remember, the pocket computer that came out. And that was a huge splash. But yeah, I remember those days pretty well. But anyway, now how did you venture into Zavello? Is this a company that you helped create? Are you the full owner? How big is your company?
I started with Zavello officially on the 9th of March, but I have been helping in the background as I transitioned off of my last mission coming into the company. I wish I could say I created Zavello, but I didn't. Zavello started back in 1984, again, going back in the day, right, as a company called eSoft, and they actually started with custom bulletin board systems, so the old BBS stuff, and then eventually moved into building technology and sort of boxes, if you will, hardware boxes that would help to protect networks from spam and all sorts of things like that. And eventually, because there's a lot of different players and bigger players in the market than that, Zavello was changed. The name was changed from eSoft to Zavello, and we were moved into web content categorization because there was definitely a need for that across the industry. Because people want to, again, we talked earlier, wanted to protect their brands, wanted to protect, kids and stuff like that from malicious and objectionable content, all of those things. And so Zavello sort of grew out of that. And what's really exciting, I think, about Zavello and one of the reasons I joined Zavello is because the company realizes when it's time to change and grow and move on from something that doesn't work or something that they're not going to be able to compete with and looking for the next right thing to do. And that's pretty exciting.
Excellent. Now, how long has Zavello been in business? And do you have a presence in other countries as well, too, or...?
Yeah, so since 84, if I did the math, that's 36 years. We have customers around the globe, and we also have our QA/QC team, which is in the Philippines.
Hello?
Yes, I'm still here, sir.
Okay, yeah. No, do you want to expand on any of those answers, or...?
So we have our QA/QC team in the Philippines, and customers around the world. The Philippines is really unique because we do human-aided machine learning, or human-supervised machine learning, excuse me. And so what that means is that sometimes, right, the machine itself goes, hey, I don't know how to categorize this particular website, and it gets kicked over to one of our analysts in the Philippines. And that allows us to follow the sun. We have a pretty remote workforce, which is obviously a good thing these days. And that allows us to grow through the challenges we see in today's working environment with COVID-19. We have folks across the country, around the world, doing our work, and it's pretty neat.
Okay, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base that you're trying to target? Is it the SMBs, the Fortune 500, or perhaps an
example? So we work, Robbie, we work with customers large and small. A lot of it depends on their needs. Some of our OEM customers are Fortune 500, fairly large companies and recognizable. But then we also will qualify folks that want to use our technology, right? So we have a pretty aggressive pricing platform for folks to be able to grab what they need. But then, again, we're looking to service, large-scale companies. We have our active web capability where we're monitoring basically what our customer sets are doing when it comes to where they're clicking, if you will, the types of stuff they're looking at. That is all to the tune of about 500 to 600 million endpoints. So we have a pretty good set of visibility across the internet. But that's all through our almost 80 primary customers, if you will, that are out there all the time using our content to protect their platforms.
Okay. Excellent. Now let's get into your product and service line. It seems like that you have distinct product service lines involving Zavello,
mm-hmm.
DB, the API, Fish Block List, and professional services. And if you can expand on these in a little bit more detail, that'd be great.
Sure, absolutely.
A couple more things that I'd like to kind of a little bit ask you after you expand on these, especially about the API and a fish block. So please go ahead, expand on your services, and we'll take it from there.
Sure, awesome. So ZvillaDB, that is our database of the base domain URL. So basically what we've done is we've taken that content, we've classified it, right, and we put it into a database that we make available through two means. We have our cloud-based capability, and then we also have our on-site deployable capability via our software development kit. A lot of our customers like to have that in-house, right, because they see in their data centers that tends to be a faster response time. So that's where we see those sort of local deployments. That's the ZvillaDB. The Zvillo API is a cloud-based capability, right? And so this is classification of full-path URLs, and that's really kind of the name of the game, right? Full-path URLs because we see threat actors out there using things like Google Docs, Dropbox, Azure, all of those things, right, to deliver malicious content, right, it's very important to be able to look at full-path URLs, which is one of the things we do. API is pretty straightforward. They can be submitted requests for one at a time. It can go in batches. API queries, we can do that as a monthly billing type thing, but we can also, if we have a customer that needs to reserve capacity for high volume requirements, we can do that as well. Fish block lists, so basically, again, human-supervised learning from a machine perspective, right, to look at all of our endpoints, right, and detect different phishing URLs, right? And the goal there is, and this is something that we're working on actively right now, is to look to better identify and categorize emerging threats that are out there, right? Obviously, phishing today from a threat perspective is the vector du jour, if you will, because we have such good network security capabilities, right, we're really driving the threat actors to, you know, delivering phishing. And it's a pendulum, right? Probably 5-6 years ago, you saw a lot of external attacks because of so many exposed holes in different websites and vulnerabilities and networks and stuff like that. You know, the community as a whole has worked really, really hard to lock a lot of that down, especially at the large-scale enterprise level for large organizations. But they've realized that phishing is the thing that still gets through, and so you still see a lot of that out there, and you also see things like business email compromises, those kinds of things. PhishBlock list is designed to help organizations stop that stuff at the beginning before it even gets into their organization. Then, of course, our professional services. So we have some world-class artificial intelligence and machine learning folks on staff, and they are available to help people model different things, whether it's using our SDK on site or whether it's something that they have, they're working on, a company or an organization is working on that needs some help, some of that high-end AI ML. And then data annotation, right, that's sort of the name of the game here. When it comes to web content categorization, it's all about the metadata. And so we have folks that are experts in going through from a big data science perspective, doing that data annotation to hopefully identify and map out the right data to display the right information for our customers.
Okay, excellent. Now, a couple of follow-ups, as I mentioned before, API. I know that API security is starting to become a big concern here in the cybersecurity realm of things. I've written a number of pieces of content on that. What are your thoughts on that? I know that OWASP came out with their top API vulnerability list, I think, some time ago. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so API security is I'm not going to say easy, because if anything in security is never easy. But API security is one of those things that if you do a good input validation, I'd say, in my opinion, 80% of the time, right, you're going to stop a bad guy from doing something, right? The unfortunate thing is with APIs is that many people, when they stand them up, don't realize what they have to do there. And a good example is about a year and a half, 2 years ago now, we saw a lot of exposures of some of the high-end databases from an API perspective, the Elasticsearches, the MongoDB, stuff like that. And that wasn't because the systems themselves were vulnerable. It was because really there was that lack of understanding of how to secure the API, right? And it's really sort of it's a specialized thing to do that right. And so APIs are important because a lot of times that's how people get access to the data that they need, right? But at the same time, it goes back to one of my favorite things to talk about, which is when you're thinking about security, you have to design it in from the front end, right? And unfortunately, many developers, right, when they throw something out on the internet, and this is just sort of the way things are right now, they throw something out on the internet, right, they're throwing it out there to get it to work. They're not necessarily doing all of that testing, and then sometimes security gets to be added on as a Band-Aid, and that's usually not the best way to do it. But from an API perspective, back to your question, they are securable, but again, it takes that malice of forethought to do that right in the first place.
Okay, now in terms of the phishing, you know, with the coronavirus pandemic that's really coming on full force now, there are a lot of cyber attackers out there now using a different phishing variants. They're not so much trying to, create fictitious PayPal websites or, banking websites. They're trying to create, fake, like World Health Organization websites where you can actually just download or where the end user is prompted to download information, but still they're submitting their personal identifiable information. What are your thoughts on that? Are we going to see different phishing variants of that nature, but will become much more sophisticated going down the road?
So, unfortunately, I don't think they have to be very sophisticated. And that's the real challenge here, right? The element, and this is one of the things, and I had an epiphany a couple years back. One of the things that I saw just in the environment itself and enterprises themselves, right, is that people are that common element, right? They're the ones that end up clicking on stuff. But I'm a firm believer that when it comes to phishing, right, if we can at least take the time to do really, really good training with our users, right, we've got a fighting chance, right? You're never, as a security professional, ever going to prevent everybody from not clicking. Somebody's going to click on something. It's going to happen. Right. And then there's another set of defenses you have to do there. But if we can help to turn our users and our folks that are actually sitting down hands on keyboard and doing the work day to day, if we can help to get those folks to be our first line defenders, right, to not be afraid to call the help desk when they think something is weird, right, and then teach our help desk folks to, hey, treat everything that comes in as a potential compromise, right, then we're actually doing better. But to your question, and it's really interesting, so we've actually been doing some research here at Zvilo over the last week or so looking at specifically domains that have been registered for or registered related to the coronavirus. So we're seeing to the tune of several thousand in the last, 30 to 45 days, domains that have been registered that have something to do with the coronavirus, right? And from a trends perspective, I was actually looking at that last night and this morning. And so the good news is probably about 25% of those are offline, which means that they're not set up and ready to work. But then I start to look at the actual domains themselves, and here's where it gets interesting. When you talked about specific campaigns, specific TTPs that an attacker might use when it comes to phishing related to this particular thing going on, right, I'm seeing and we're seeing at Zvilo, we're seeing like regional domains. Like you'll see like coronavirus Chicago dot whatever. You'll see coronavirus California whatever, right? And these are all different kinds of domains that are potentially very concerning, right? If you are going to stand up a phishing campaign and go after, say, people in California, you would want that to look somewhat legitimate, right? And so the challenge with phishing is that it doesn't necessarily have to be totally legitimate, right? Because in times like this, attackers tend to prey on the fear that's going on, right? People now, when they think they're going to get that right piece of information that helps them, not be sick or whatever the case may be, right, or protect a family member or something like that, they're more likely to let their guard down. And when they do that, that's when the attackers win, right? And so cybersecurity and paying attention to, not clicking on stuff and paying attention to who's actually sending you emails, right, and looking at all of that stuff, it's hard to think about that right now because everybody's kind of freaking out. But if we don't do that, right, we risk compromising a great many things, not only from a personal perspective, but with so much of the workforce moved to a work-from-home remote environment, right? There's so many things that could potentially happen bad there, and then we all have more problems than we'd like to think about.
Okay, excellent. Now, can you tell us more about the technological architecture that you use for your products and services? Is it AI pretty much that is the backbone?
So, yeah, so we have, and so that's a good question. So, so we have a variety of different techniques that we use, right? So we have some, we're working towards fully automation in the future, right? But from an AI perspective, we have both supervised and unsupervised methods in the mix. We do use a lot of natural language processing technologies, and so that's basically, think of you and I having a conversation. Basically, the machine is reading things like we're having a conversation. It's pretty neat. And then we have those different algorithms in there as well from an incorporation perspective. We look at rules-based. We look at tree-based. We also have deep learning. So we use all of those techniques, and we are working on a daily basis to improve the AI and improve the machine learning. The second piece that we do is human-supervised machine learning. And so we have some really skilled analysts that I mentioned previously out in the Philippines. And we're always training our data sets, right, because we have humans that check the machine, right? And so we actually do on a regular basis sample what's in our database, and then we have human analysts check it to make sure the machine's getting it right. And then if we have to, we retrain. And so the goal there is to make our answers, if you will, when you go to zvelo.com and you check out our tools.zvelo.com, the goal there is that when you type in that URL or you're one of our customers and you're using our database, the URLs that are coming back to you are appropriately content categorized so that we can ensure we're getting the right information out.
Okay. Can you tell us in more detail how your fish block list service can actually protect email? I think this would be a good area to expand on more, especially to our audience.
Sure, absolutely. So fish block list, right, was really grown out of the idea that we had customers that didn't want the entire Zvelo DB, which is, you know, millions upon millions of URLs, right? What they specifically right. wanted was phishing URLs. Right, so that's what is there in fish block list, right? And so the idea was is that obviously when it comes to a malicious categorization, right, phishing is one of those subsets, right? And so what fish block does is very similar to our Zvelo DB. Our customers can integrate that locally, or they can hit the API, right? And the goal is that they use that in their engine locally to protect a user, right? So typically done for email coming into an enterprise, and then after that, you just don't ever get the fish, if you will.
Okay. Now, how can the general public at large, like the average person out in the street, check for categorization? I know you kind of explained what content categorization is, but can you expand on that mm-hmm. into a little bit more detail as to how it's relevant to the average everyday person or to the SMB and how they can use it?
No, absolutely. So obviously, right, so every day there's new URLs and stood up, there's new domains registered, all of those kinds of things, right? And so the easiest way for the general public to get information, right, and we make this available to the general public, is they go to tools.zvelo.com, and at tools.zvelo.com, they can simply submit a URL and see what the content, what the categorization comes back as. So, for example, if you went to tools.zvelo.com right now, if you typed in www.cnn.com, right, and you hit the reCAPTCHA, and when you click Get Results, it comes back and tells you the categorization. And so what you'll see on our website, right, is 9 tiles. And you'll have the content category. In this case, it'll be streaming and downloadable video and international news. And then you'll see something that says IAB, and that's the International Advertisers Bureau. So we look at the tiers, and then we look at the content rating based on the IAB. And the goal here, right, is to mm-hmm. let people very quickly, if they're an advertiser, look and see mm-hmm. if that's a place that they would want to serve one of their ads to. So we also help with ad tech, right? So you'll see that, and then you'll see if it's brand safe, is it malicious, and then if there's any objectionable material related to that website. Okay, so that's if that's in our database, right? But obviously, many times there are things that may not be in our database, right? And so that's where if you enter that URL, right, that URL, if it's not our database, you won't get any results back, right? And that's effectively submitting that URL, right, for categorization, right? And then our machine or one of our analysts will take a look at that. The other thing that's really cool that the general public can do is, let's say that you're a small but a mid-sized business out there, and for some reason your business's website was miscategorized. At the same place, tools.zvlo.com, you can actually make a suggestion on recategorization, right, and report that. And so that's two ways that the general public can utilize the information that we provide. Obviously, if you're a small business, right, if you don't have a lot of resources, you can come here and check, websites you might be seeing in your logs and stuff like that, that your users might be going to that might potentially be malicious or they may not be. It just depends on, what is happening in the world today.
Okay. Now, what if one of your customers thinks that there is a categorization that is incorrect? Do you have like a 24-hour support line that they can contact or email to report this or get their concerns addressed?
Absolutely, yeah. So
how do you
absolutely? Yep. So they absolutely do, right? So they can either do it via the website, right, or if they're one of our customers, right, they have basically a direct line to our quality assurance analysts, right? And so they can send that email. We actually have that box is monitored 24/7, and then folks automatically get that get their categorizations fixed. We do it depending on our customers, right? If it's a customer of ours, we do it in bulk. If it's like a one-off that's been submitted at the website, right, one of our analysts will get back with them.
Okay. Now we all have heard about the dark web, the public web, the active web. What exactly mm-hmm. is the active web? And even to kind of extrapolate on the question, can you kind of differentiate for our audience, like what is the public web, the dark web, and the active web?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll start with public web and dark web first, right? So public web is everything that's been crawled by a search engine, so think Google, right? The dark web is simply networks and content and stuff like that that has not been or is not allowed to be directly crawled by Google or other search engines, right? So that's kind of the definitization, right? So the internet as a whole is a very large and organic piece of technology that obviously spans the globe. But there are obviously places on the internet, the dark web, where people don't want a typical search engine categorizing them. However, when you look at like the Tor browser and stuff like that, you can actually search through all of those capabilities and see what's out there. And trust me, there's a lot of yucky and nasty stuff on the dark web that most people don't ever want to see. And so you typically don't go there. And that's why those are blocked from being crawled by, say, Google. When it comes to the active web, that's a Zvlo categorization of the way we look at the web. And so we define the web, or the active web, as those URLs that are being actively visited through our global network of partners, right? So these are our end users, right, that are served by Zvlo DB, whether it's the API or the SDK in an organization, right? And so across the globe, we've got more than 500, almost 600 million plus users now that are being served by our database. And so when one of those users clicks on a link, right, then that gets registered in our database, right? The content categorization gets checked, and then we move on, right? So we have a pretty good bead. In fact, we've actually been doing some interesting metrics and looking at the active web right now in terms of how different users do different things. As a funny aside, right, I was actually looking at that data set a couple of days back, and you look at all of the content out there, and then we think of everything that's going on in the world today, right, and like a half a percentage point is what we're seeing online for, say, shopping. Right, so it's a unique data set, and it allows us to have some very interesting, sort of real-time insights in terms of what basically 600 million folks are doing on the internet.
Wow. Okay, now, Brad, I think these next two questions are going to kind of, I guess, go hand in hand. Could you elaborate more on your AI and ML platforms And with regards to that, I know that AI, you know, you got to have a lot of like data feeds and so forth. And what kind of data points, what kind of data feeds do you use if you're allowed to share that kind of information with us?
So we have a lot of trusted feeds that we bring in, especially from, like, say, for on our malicious side, for a threat intel perspective, we have a number of different feeds that we look at and that we call them trusted feeds, and that helps us with that, right? Obviously, from an AI perspective, right, that's kind of the secret sauce that we won't talk too much about, right? But ultimately, probably the big thing to drive out is that yes, we do have an AI engine. But the big thing we do is that human-supervised machine learning, right? One of the things that's extremely challenging in this particular environment is that the Internet is always changing, right? And so we're seeing a lot of content move to what we would call active content now versus static content, right? So we're working diligently right now to better categorize that stuff, right? HTML code? Pretty easy to categorize, right? It's got headers, it's got a footer. We can get a pretty good, the machine can get a good gauge in terms of how we do that, right? But when it comes to, like, say, scripted stuff on a website, right, those are things that we're now teaching our machines how to figure out, right? And so it's a constantly evolving and learning process with our AI and ML, and it's a pretty exciting time to be at Zavilo because we're actually making strides to get to that point, and that's going to allow us to continue to better serve our customers in the out years.
Okay. What exactly is meant by human-supervised machine learning? Is this where human intervention is involved, like with checking the optimization of the data feeds or actually manually plugging in the data feeds the first time?
It's kind of both, right? So supervised machine learning from our perspective, right, is where we do two things. One, we check what the machine is doing, right? So that's sort of step one, right? So let's say you have 10 URLs. Right, we send them to the machine. The machine says, "I think this is this, this, and this, and this other thing." The machine has 480 categories that we do for content categorization, and so that can be a little confusing because, you know, a sailing boat, if you will, might be a little different from an airplane, right? And so maybe the machine gets it wrong, right? And so that's where our QA/QC analysts come in. They go and then look at the outputs of that and say, hey, did the machine get it right? Did the machine get it wrong? If the machine got it right, then we move on. If the machine didn't get it right, we look to see if there was something that we need to fix with the algorithms, and then we fix that and we move on, right? The other thing that the machine does is when something comes back as a miscategorization, right? So obviously, with the active web, we're always getting those links and clicks, and we're always, you know, continually feeding the beast, if you will, right? But again, it's a machine that's been trained over time, and so sometimes the machine will get it wrong. And so our QA/QC analysts will look to see and understand why the machine got it wrong, and then if there's a fix that needs to be made, we make that fix so that we get those categorizations right in the next time.
Okay, excellent. Now, obviously, everyone wants a safer web experience because even sometimes I get spoofed. I think there was one time I logged into almost a very, very real-looking PayPal website, and it was actually a spoofed website. I was able to tell right in the URL. It was very hard to detect. Now, tell us about your partnerships with the IWF, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the AWPG. How do your products and services help parents protect their kids? I know that cyberbullying now is a big it's not anymore physical bullying on the high school grounds or, you know, school premises. It's now cyberbullying. So how does it all intertwine together, and how do you keep kids safe in that regard?
So that's an excellent question. So we're actually a member of those organizations, right? Because that fits into the Zavilo mission. That fits into the Zavilo mission of making the Internet safer for everyone, right? So the way this works is that our obviously our OEM partners, right, which are using Zavilo capabilities and their parental controls, we have a number of large organizations that do that, right, that helps to ultimately protect, you know, kids from online predators, objectionable content, that kind of thing. When it comes to cyberbullying, right, that's a little trickier. We don't necessarily directly do that. I wish that we could, because it is a huge problem. But cyberbullying is one of those things that really comes down to similar to what we talked about before. It's educating users, educating kids. It's parents sitting down with their kids and talking them through those kinds of things, right, to help them understand that that is something that actually happens in the world today, unfortunately. And again, I wish that our stuff could actually stop all of that stuff, but I really am proud of the fact that we're able to be a part of these organizations and help them to help them indirectly, if you will, with our capabilities that are deployed.
Yeah, excellent. Now, mobile security. I've written quite a bit of pieces of content, like articles and blogs for numerous clients. In fact, I just wrote one on how to create like a remote workforce, you know, securely, as well as the mobility security issues given the threat environment today. This is a hot button topic, obviously, and will probably continue to be for a long time as we see the smartphones becoming really like an extension of our personal and professional lives. How do your products and services help with the mobile devices, securing them, you know, like smartphones, tablets, notebooks, that kind of thing?
No, absolutely. So what's really cool and what's really awesome about our product set is that once they're integrated with one of our partners, our OEM partners, our customers, right, no matter what, that's where that that capability helps to protect them. So we have several customers that are large mobile providers, right? And so what they do is they want to prevent objectionable malicious content from getting to those users, right? And so with our product in line, right, that stuff never makes it to those users, right, which is and on their devices, be it a smartphone, be it a tablet, whatever the case may be. So that's pretty exciting, right? That's where the rubber meets the road for us, is to stop that before it even gets there. And so that's a great capability. I think it's really unique, though, that we're seeing so much transition to the mobile environment, right? And we see a couple of things with that in the near future that I think are going to be incredibly important. One is chat, right? So I don't know. I've got way too many Slack channels, I'm pretty sure, but there's also Mattermost. There's all sorts of capabilities out there that if you integrate our product set, right, you can actually help to protect those, like links posted into different chat boxes and stuff like that, right? So that's another area that we're looking at. I think that when it comes to mobile devices, this is not going to stop. This is going to continue to grow. We're going to continue to see an expansion of that. The general public across the globe enjoys the convenience of being able to access their stuff anywhere. And so I think that it's important for organizations as a whole to look for capabilities and products that can help to protect not only themselves, but can protect their customers and their users across the board, be they a provider, be they an enterprise-scale organization. This type of stuff, spoofed websites, phishing emails, business email compromise, are things that are going to continue, you know, into the foreseeable future, and I don't think we're going to stop threat actors necessarily from ever ending that, because every day thousands of people around the globe, probably more than that, right, click on something that compromises, be it their phone, be it a laptop, be it a tablet, be it their systems at home, right? And that is the thing that's super concerning when you look at it from a broader cybersecurity perspective.
Well, okay. Now, have you dealt with other threat variants that are out there, like ransomware, business email compromise, crypto mining? And also, have you done any work with social engineering? Because in my view, I think that's going to be it's starting to be used quite a bit, but I think it's going to really explode right now, the current crisis that we have right now. You know, it's not so much sending out, you know, emails and so forth, but it's actually people calling on their phone or sending, you know, fake text messages. Have you done any work also with social engineering in those kinds of aspects as well, too?
That's one of my favorite things, is social engineering, because it is the common denominator, The challenge with social engineering, Ravi, I think, is that we as humans tend to be very, very trusting. That's like, you know, we don't like to say no. We want to help people, right? That's just sort of human nature. And so when that happens, right, when somebody calls, right, and if you don't have the ubiquitous stuff today of, you know, blocking malicious callers, that kind of stuff, right, you know, you ultimately have that thing where you get, you get fished, if you will, from a real-time perspective, right? And what's unfortunate is that many people don't realize it's happening, right? One of the things you see in organizations, and I've seen in organizations that I work with over the years, right, is you'll get the I've gone in to do whether it's threat hunting or cyber incident response, where you walk into an organization and they go, we don't know how this happened. And then you start to dig a little deeper and you find out that, you know, Bob was called by, and we'll go air quotes, the help desk, but it wasn't really the help desk. It was somebody that said, oh, hey, it's the help desk. We need to fix your computer, and can you go to this website and download this thing so we can have remote access? That unfortunately happens more often than not. And unfortunately, a particularly vulnerable set of that population is our older folks. I've got older parents and older in-laws and that kind of stuff, right? And my great-grandmother, my kid's great-grandmother, my wife's grandmother, she had, I don't know how much ransomware and stuff like that on her laptop. Thankfully, it didn't detonate. But, I mean, she had all of this stuff on there because she got an email or she got a phone call, and these people said, oh, we're here to help you, right? And that's scary.
Right. Yeah, it really is very scary. You have no idea, Brad, how many times I keep getting inundated with phone calls. I'm at the point now, I just let it go to voicemail. I don't even answer unless I know who it is. But what's even scarier is that, like, on my iPhone, on the iOS device, usually when I get a call, it will say the name of the person from my contact book. But even now, I think the cyber attacker, the phisher for that matter, they're heisting, I think, even contact books from these wireless devices and kind of trying to reach into people that way, tricking them to think it's a real legitimate call from their, friend or, contact or whatever,
Oh, so absolutely. It's really scary. One of the biggest things you'll see is like, and they've gotten really good about this because it is, honestly, there's an app you can download on your phone to spoof phone numbers. Right? You can get it for free.
Wow.
It's awesome. Oh, yeah. And so that stuff's out there, right? And unfortunately, it wasn't necessarily created for good things, right? And so, I don't know how many times a day I'll get a phone call, like you said, on my smartphone, that's like it's from the area code that I'm in, right? Because human nature, you go, oh, that must be somebody it must be somebody I know, right? And so, unfortunately, I think that that's going to continue to happen, over time. Attackers are going to morph and change their vectors no matter what because they want to ultimately, and the vast majority of these folks, right, are cyber criminals, right? And whether they're, whether they're the large-time cyber criminals that you think of, that come out of places like Russia and other things like that, right, or even if they're just small-time cyber criminals, right, their goal is to get just one person. They just need one person, right, to give them that credit card information, give them a social security number, right, let them on their computer or system, right? They only need one person to do that, right, and they've made their money for the day, right? And that's where it's concerning, right? And it's kind of interesting when you think back across like the history of the internet when it was created, right, and then ultimately grown and loved by academics who believe that sharing was a good thing and everybody should share and what bad things could happen, and then you had the Morris worm, and then all the bets were off.
Okay. Now, let's kind of segue back to your company again. Do you have any customer success stories or client testimonials or even case studies that you could share with us?
So not directly. We tend to protect our customers, pretty in depth, right? So that they've got their stuff protected. I will tell you from a success story perspective, though, that we have a lot of customers that come back to us and tell us that they appreciate all of the content, especially on the malicious side of the house, that we help them to not serve through to their customers. And that's really one of our biggest success stories. Our goal, right, is to make sure that we are helping to make the internet safer for everybody, which is why we maintain such a large database of content categorization, so that we can ensure that folks are getting good content and the right content and the properly categorized content, so that they're not having things happen to them that shouldn't.
Okay. Is there any specific case that you can reference or mention without giving client name, or it's still kind of all confidential?
Sure. No, that's okay. So last week we actually ran across a brand issue that was interesting. Hmm. So we found some. We talked back about the coronavirus stuff. So we were doing some investigation on some of the coronavirus domains. And we discovered what we call a redirector on two specific domains, pointing to something that looked, we'll say, semi-legitimate. We ultimately determined, working with the organization, that it was a legitimate website that just looked weird. But those redirectors pointed to this website. This website was unfortunately serving malicious content to whoever went to it. And so basically it was reaching out via a third-party plugin on the website, and that third-party plugin was serving an executable file that, when it dropped on your desktop, it would execute itself, it would spawn a bunch of malicious processes, it would open up a back door on your system, and then it would communicate out via cutdown telegram, via port 443, and establish persistence. It was a pretty nasty little bug. And this was all being done on this legitimate website, unbeknownst to the owner. And so we were able to do a disclosure with that. We talked to the registrars. We talked to the owner of the content. And the good news is that that third party provider, right, that was ultimately serving that stuff, A, cleaned up their stuff, and B, the site where the malicious executable was sitting was taken down by one of our customers. And so that's a really good success story, right? We have some pretty unique insights at zVelo to be able to catch some of that stuff a little early. And so when we do that, if we see something that looks very suspicious, right, and we can identify who the content belongs to, we go directly to them, be they a customer or not, to help clean that up. That's how we help to make the internet, safer for everybody, right? When we see something, we're going to say something. We're not going to just hope that it goes away.
Okay, excellent. Now, Brad, I get the next one's going to be like two sub-questions. It seems like that zVelo serves a very unique and specific niche. So I was just kind of wondering, how big is that competitive landscape? And two, why should a customer come to you? I mean, there are thousands and thousands of cybersecurity vendors out there around the world. Why should they come and say, hey, to you, Brad, I like your stuff, I want to come to you? What separates you from the rest of the crowd?
So what separates us right now is our data access. We have, over the last few months, have gained some very unique accesses into some data sets that allow us to get out and be more proactive, right? So we're working right now to develop a technology set that will allow us to get the content categorization specifically focused on the malicious side of the house into our database sooner and faster than our competitors, with the goal of ensuring that we get that we cover more than everybody else. And so right now, because of our active web, we get basically 99.9% coverage of what's going on across the globe from an internet perspective. So that's pretty unique. You don't find that anywhere else. Obviously, our competitors are out there, and it is a fairly small competitive space. But our competitors out there, right? So I would like to say that they're not quite as good as we are, especially from a data access perspective as of late. And so we're pretty excited to be able to get to the point where we're going to not only have the active web, but we're going to have a proactive capability that allows us to get out in front of some of these trends in advance, right, to better protect our customers.
Okay, excellent. Now, let me see here. Do you offer any free trials or, like, free risk assessments for your customer before you onboard them? Do you also rely on value-added resellers or have, like, a partnership model to kind of, like, get your name out there, too?
So on the second part, not really. We try to do most of our stuff standalone. So the way it works is if a customer comes to us and says, "Hey, I'm really super interested in your product set. What can you do for us?" Right. What we'll do is we'll evaluate that customer and help to qualify them to see if they're a good fit. And then what we typically do is we provide a smaller subset of the database, typically about 10,000 URLs, right? As part of a micro, if you will, SDK deployment. They then take that test data, integrate it in their environment, see if it works for them, right? Free trial, if you will, right? At the end, if that happens and they like it and it works, then we go ahead and get them onboarded as one of our customers, depending on what their needs are.
Okay. Now, does the federal government make use of your products and services? I would think that right now with this heightened increase of security that they could probably reach out to you. Because I know that the World Health Organization was hit, like I think the Scoop website, and I think there were some other government websites where some, I think, spoofed domains or malicious domains, if you will, were registered. Have you seen an uptick in that market for you?
So we haven't yet, and so we don't directly support the federal government right now, but we kind of do indirectly because many of our customers that we provide our services to, right, actually are providers to the federal government, right? So sort of indirectly we support that market, right, but we've not actually had those direct discussions with the federal government yet.
Do you think you might have any plans to down the road, or is this kind of let it happen?
I think we may. Yeah, I think we may, Ravi. I think again, there's so many things going on right now in the space that it would be hard for me anyways not to imagine that we would not at some point go down that road. But you know, we'll see how that goes depending on the world situation.
Sure. Now, of course, we'll go on to a topic that's everybody's heard of, obviously, which is coronavirus or COVID-19. What do you and the fellows are seeing on the web related to this pandemic in terms of, I guess, like fake domains, fake websites? And if you can provide a couple tips what we should be looking for to stay safe so we don't go to a spooked website?
No, absolutely. So first off, we are seeing malicious cyber actors, or what I like to call MCAs. They're out there looking right now to drive potential victims to watering holes. They're trying to get people to go to their websites, right? They're creating very, very realistic-looking websites that may or may not be something you want to visit. And that is very, very concerning. We're also seeing, this is very similar to what we saw with Hurricane Florence in 2018, where we're seeing a lot of folks, you know, sending out information that says, "Hey, you know, click here to donate stuff," and those kinds of things, right? And so, you know, some base level tips that I would recommend, right? You know, if you get an email, right, that claims to represent something, you should validate that, right? Don't just click on the link, right? This is another thing we see out here, right, is if somebody calls from your bank or financial institution, right, or something like that, right, you know, again, validate that. Your bank isn't just going to call you bolt out of the blue, right? You know, we're going to probably see people that are going to make threats related to, hey, you know, the typical tax time scan. Hey, you know, you owe the IRS thousands of dollars. You should, you know, you got to send us these gift cards, right? don't do that, right? That's always a good indicator, right, of bad things happening. I'm going to be very interested to see what happens now that they've shifted the tax submission date from April 15th to July 15th. I mean, that's pretty interesting, right? That's going to create its own set of things, right? Pay attention to stuff. People are going to prey on your fears and your concerns, right? So, for example, if somebody, sends you an email, calls you and says, oh, hey, your loved one is in the hospital. They're very, very sick. You need to send them money or they're not going to get treated. Don't believe any of that stuff, right? The biggest thing I would say in all of these things, right, is that if it seems unbelievable or it seems too good to be true or it seems that there's, you know, there's something fishy about it, you know, pun intended, right? Don't click on the link. Don't give them their information over the phone, right? Be on your guard and be vigilant, right? Unfortunately, and it's really unfortunate that in, you know, this time of, you know, challenge, if you will, when we're dealing with this global pandemic, is that people would look to take advantage of that, right? And that's the side of this side of the business that I don't like. It's like, come on, guys, we don't need to do that. It's really actually interesting. There was a story out last week that the typical ransomware folks that go after hospitals and medical facilities, right, have decided to take a holiday during this time,
right.
Which is probably more self-preservation than anything else. Again, that also seems strange and kind of weird all at the same time. But again, there's stuff out there, right? But arm yourself with information, right? Don't click on that link, right? Don't give that information, right? Know that organizations aren't going to call you and ask for specific personally identifiable information, right? They're going to send you that via like something in the mail or something like that. It's not going to necessarily be something that happens over the phone. And that's where a lot of times folks get caught. And it's unfortunate, but it is the situation and the environment that we're operating in right now.
Brad, I gotta tell you, I gotta be honest with at least myself. I mean, we're in cybersecurity, so we're trained to, you know, think twice before you hit the send button or download something. But it's still a knee-jerk reaction. You know, that's just our human psyche. If we say, hey, someone needs your help, we want to be helpful. If someone's like, one of our friends is sick or something, we just want to jump at it. It's just, I think, not reacting to that knee-jerk reaction, I guess that's the hard part, which is what I'm trying to get at. Like, for example, luckily we just got our taxes filed a few weeks ago. You know, my wife and I are on the Obamacare, and I've been very careful to make sure that all of our letters are real and legitimate, all of our tax documentation. But I got something in the mail that was something about a 1095-B form. And I was going, okay, what is this? So my first reaction was, oh, my gosh, I didn't get this to my account. We're going to have to file an amended tax return. Oh, what's going on here? That was my knee-jerk reaction. But after telling myself, okay, calm down, just take a closer look at it, I could kind of tell that it was a spoofed snail mail letter because some of the capitalization in my wife's name was screwed up. And I did call healthcare.gov. They said, no, we don't have anything to do with 1095-B. So once I realized that, okay, this is a fake letter. But, you know, cyber attackers are even sending out fake letters, too. I mean, it's just gotten so out of hand, you know. Go ahead.
No, as you say, it absolutely is. And that's another thing, right? I mean, you know, like what's the QR codes? That's one of my favorites.
Right.
How many mailers do you get that have a QR code? Lots.
Right.
Do you ever look? Do you ever scan them? I don't. Right? But a lot of people do, right? And so those are potentially things that could be easily spoofed, right? And take advantage of that trust that we have. We inherently, especially in the United States and in the Western world, we tend to be very trusting that, you know, nobody's going to use our technology against us, right? And, you know, having played an attacker on TV before, if you will, right? I'm going to use every advantage that I can. Right. If I'm an attacker, I want to try every possible vector. Right. Because my goal, ultimately, especially on the cyber criminal side of the house, is to make a little money. Right. And if I can get you to click on that QR code that you know opens up a backdoor on your smartphone that allows me to take all of your contacts and you know bank account information. Hey, I'm going to do that. right? And so, and those vectors can be as simple as that QR code. It could be as simple as that link in your email. It could be as simple as, you know, you getting redirected, you know, via an ad on a website to a watering hole that looks something like a legitimate thing that you want to visit, right? And so, you know, attackers are always working the different angles and techniques, right, to play on that human perspective that we all have, right, that serves us and helps us a lot of the times, right, but sometimes can cause us to be a little scattered, right, especially during a time like this where, you know, there's so many potential sources of information out there. How do we actually cull through all of that, right, to get to the thing that is actually real?
I mean, for that matter, I don't even download any mobile apps. I have maybe just one or two, and that's about it. It's so hard to tell what's even fake or anything anymore because I know Apple does a very good job. They have very stringent policies on what can be uploaded for a mobile app. But I know Google Play, they're very lax in that regard. So anyway, let's segue over just into the general cyber threat landscape as we come to the last part of our show here. We keep hearing about nation-state threat actors, you know, such as North Korea, China, Russia, and so forth. And I'm assuming our presidential elections won't be postponed or anything. Hopefully, you know, they'll still go on as scheduled. So the big thing is obviously the 2020 presidential elections. And I've got to be honest here, Bob. I think one of the biggest fears is the use of deep fake technology. It's an AI-driven threat variant. It's, so, for example, basically, you know, we see Donald Trump for real, you know, on TV, but anybody could, you know, create a replica of that and kind of use that to create a spoofed website asking for campaign mm-hmm. donations that's really going to be wired to some malicious third-party account in China. So what are your thoughts on that? Like, what do you think about this deep fake threat variant?
Well, one, it's cheap and easy to do. You know, there's how many – I love open source software. It's one of my favorite things, but it's also one of the things that gives me heartache and headaches as a cyber defender, right? Because just about anybody out there can get a hold of some of this technology and create things that look very, very real. And so that's out there, right? I'm kind of a connoisseur of that kind of stuff. You might say it's Brad, why are you a connoisseur of propaganda? That's because one of my areas of training when I was being in the Army was something called information operations, right? And so that's where I look at messaging and how that happens and how do you deliver messages to a specific, you know, populace or organization or stuff like that, right? And so I look at that kind of thing from a little bit different angle. And sometimes, you know, if I'm wandering about the social media landscape, right, I'll see stuff that gives me the willies. And go, huh, that feels really off to me. That's probably not created or produced by a U.S. person or a U.S. organization, right? Or a just, you know, John Q. Public, right? That looks like somebody did something specific. And I'll give you a practical example. Back on Veterans Day last year, I was looking at some stuff on social media, and I ran across the picture. And the picture was an airplane in flight, and it was doing something called an angel flight. And an angel flight is where you take and you fire off the flares off the back of the plane. It spreads out, and it looks like an angel's wings. It's a pretty cool picture when you think about it, right? And so it was a Veterans Day. And it was hey, you know, thank a veteran, happy veterans, you know, happy Veterans Day, right? Which is clearly a U.S. holiday and stuff like that. And so I stopped because I look at the picture and I go, that doesn't feel right, right? Because it wasn't a picture of a U.S. aircraft. It was a picture of a Russian aircraft, right? And so I sat there and said to myself, I wonder, right, where that came from and who posted that, right, and why was it posted that way, right, and how many people had responded to that, which was cool. Hey, thank a veteran, veterans, yeah, thank you, veterans, blah, 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 all this stuff is great, right? But when I thought about that, I thought, man, right, that's a Russian plane, right? And so that's as that's how easy this is, right? It's how easy it is, again, that human side of things, right, to pull that human in to sort of following the crowd, if you will, right? And that's why deep fakes work, right? That's why these kinds of things are a technique that is very, very used today in the threat landscape, because it's really hard. unless you look or know what you're looking for to actually catch something like that, right? And there's no fault of anybody out there. I think any of us, myself included, all right, could be somebody that gets faked out, if will. But that's something that I think we have to be concerned about as a general public, just to understand that there are actors out there that have stated doctrine that they want to influence our population, want to influence the outcomes of elections, right? This is something that happens. It's a statecraft thing. It's not something that is surprising to any of us that have been in the business, right, whether it's the military or in cybersecurity for a long time. We know that that's what these actors want to do. It's catching it and recognizing it and debunking stuff like that. That's the real challenge.
Okay. Now, what are your general thoughts on the Internet of Things? To me, I find that to be a very scary proposition because it's just, everything's all interconnected in both the virtual and physical worlds, and in my opinion, it just increases the attack surface, obviously, for the hacker. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Do you have a smart home or a smart car, or what are your thoughts on it?
So I have very limited smart home. I have a couple of Alexas. Right, Echo Dots, I guess, right? So I talk to Alexa because she tells me the weather, and it's great. But I, as a cybersecurity guy, I know the risk, right? But as an example, I had a long discussion with my spouse about, should we get an Internet-enabled, Wi-Fi-enabled thermostat? And I said, not only no, but heck no. I said, I don't trust that, right? And so there's so many things when it comes to IoT that are happening today, and unfortunately, at least in my perspective, right, that we're starting to get where we see things that, get ahead of the security technology, right? Everybody's racing right now to put the next thing on the Internet. And you have to ask yourself, why would you put that on the Internet? And what does that do for, just security in general, right? Because ultimately, IoT is here. We're going to have to deal with it, right? Cisco right now is looking at the numbers a few weeks back. They're projecting that by 2030, there's going to be approximately 500 billion things on the Internet, right? That's a huge number. That outstrips – here's the thing that's scary, Robbie. That outstrips IPv6. Right, I heard about a year ago that people are looking at having to do network address translation or NAT like we did for IPv4 for IPv6. I said, "What? We got plenty of IP addresses." And then I looked at that number and I went, "We don't have enough IP addresses. Holy cow, we are going to have to NAT IPv6." Right? That's going to give attackers a whole lot more places to hide, right? And a whole lot more surfaces to work with, right? I think I'm a huge fan of automation. I love some of the stuff that we do for convenience, right? But I'm a huge fan also of doing it with some risk in mind, right? You have to understand that if you connect something to the Internet, whether it's at your business or at your house or something like that, right, there's a risk, right? There's a risk that device, right, might be compromisable, right? For example, we look at like the Mirai botnet back in the 2016 and the Dyn DNS distributed denial of service, right? Who would have thunk that all of these Internet-facing cameras, which were Internet-facing so that folks could access them from afar, which is cool, right, would have hard-coded passwords that you couldn't change, right? And that's what allowed that attack to happen. And, oh, by the way, Mirai is still out there. People are still looking for ways to deliver those types of DDoS attacks, right? And that's all because of an attack surface that continues to grow. I think another thing that I get a little frustrated with is vendors, and this is a general statement and just my humble opinion. A lot of times what vendors do is they'll send out devices with every capability turned on. I'll give you a good example. Got my wife a printer a few months back. That printer came with every single port enabled on it that it needed to do printing, which is great, right, if I really wanted those ports on, so I had to go and selectively turn off those ports. And so that is one of those things that I get really frustrated with, because I believe that vendors should be sending out products that have everything turned off, right, and then help users understand when they turn something on, what is the risk?
Were you wanting to expand on something there, Brad? Or?
Well, I'm trying to think if there was excuse me. Again, that's like one of those things, right? It's here's the thing, and here's the thing that's really scary, right, is that malicious cyber actors, those MCAs we talked about, right, they're always looking for that, right? They're just as good, right, as my defenders are in terms of determining the holes in these different capabilities, right? And so it really comes down in my mind to helping people, helping the general public, helping, you know, IT folks, helping anybody that deploys technology understand that when you put something on the internet, right, there is inherently a risk that goes with it, right? And if you know the risk and accept the risk, right, hopefully nothing bad happens. But if something bad happens, you knew what the risk was when you put it on the internet. Most folks don't think that way. And I think that in the era today, that's something we have to help folks shift to.
Okay. Now, this is kind of off-the-cuff question, but this is another hot-button topic in cybersecurity today, is that cybersecurity insurance policies, have you dealt with that for your clients or Zavello in any way? Because have they asked you, like, do you offer any kind of insurance package with your services, or do you give advice or anything like that, or?
So we don't offer insurance with our services or anything like that. We are well aware of the stuff that's out in the public right now when it comes to cybersecurity insurance. I think that we have a long way to go there. excuse me. I have a good friend of mine. She does that. She actually started a startup with that. And right now the space when it comes to cyber insurance, from what I've seen, still kind of the wild, wild west. Trying to figure out what it is from a policy perspective, trying to understand a lot of it's tracking back to talking with my friend. It's tracking back to risk management and doing those things right. Even doing just the basics of cyber hygiene helps when it comes to your premiums, right? But just like any kind of insurance, right, there's exceptions to those policies, and that's where folks have to be really careful.
Okay, excellent. Now, back to development, do you have any plans for expansion of your products and services or expanding your markets or expanding your geographic location?
So one of the big things that we're looking right now, right, is we're looking to, especially on our malicious detection side of the house, is integration specifically of observed and trended cybersecurity IOCs. So we have a lot of customers out there that are very interested in not understanding just that something is malicious, but they want to understand the why. They want to understand the indicators of compromise associated with it. They want to know the malware family. So we're working to do and build out that metadata set to improve that service and get that into the hands of our customers.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come up to the last two questions of the show here, I'll kind of couple the two of them together. How do you foresee the cyber threat landscape evolving? Obviously, I guess what the pundits predicted back in December and January, it's probably now out the door with the coronavirus. So what are your thoughts on that? And two, do you have a laundry list of, you know, top 10 or top 5 things you tell people to how to mitigate the risk of cyber attack? I mean, I shouldn't even say how to avoid from being a victim, because we all can be. But if you become a victim, how quickly can you mitigate that risk of anything happening further?
No, absolutely. So from a threat landscape perspective, right, is the biggest thing to know is that malicious cyber actors out there, right, they're going to continue to adapt, right? If you remember growing up watching the Tom and Jerry cartoon, right, it was always the cat and mouse game. Tom was always losing to Jerry because Jerry was awesome. And every time you thought that Tom had caught Jerry, right, Jerry figured out another way, right? Well, that's our malicious cyber actors, right? They're always looking, and I'll use this sort of the military term here. We call it an avenue of approach, right? So, for example, if we take and we block everything, you know, inbound on our firewalls except for, you know, web traffic and DNS traffic, right? Well, guess what? The threat actors are going to find another approach to get in. They're going to say, hey, they blocked us. We can't access their systems internally. What do we do next? Well, then we move to phishing, right? Well, they started that. Now they put in fish block list from Zvilo. Now what do we do? Well, now we're going to get more advanced on our phishing, right? Now we're going to move to IP address type stuff. I mean, so the threat actors are out there. I think that's the one thing we're always going to see in the threat environment is that the threat actors are going to continue to try and change things, right? But here's the thing, right? We talked a little bit about IoT. As IoT evolves, right, we're going to continue to see a growth in surface areas, right? And it's not just the devices themselves. It's not just the things you put on the internet, right? It's the services that you use to access those. So most devices, right, that you put on the internet from an IoT perspective, right, have what? They have a app that you download on your smartphone, right? It reaches out to a website, right? If the organization that made the IoT device, right, isn't and doesn't necessarily understand cybersecurity, right, you have to ask yourself, how secure is their website that I'm accessing my IoT device through, right? And what would happen if somebody got into that central control point, if you will, for all these IoT devices and then broke a bunch of stuff? That's a possibility, right? So, again, it goes back to that whole entire discussion when it comes to risk management, those types of things. So that's super important. To your second question, Robbie, is, you know, what do I recommend? What do I say to people when it comes to that? How do they protect themselves, right? I look at sort of this basic list of things. One, you need to know your assets, right? And so that's kind of a broad statement. And most people, when they think about assets, is they think about the hardware. They think about the laptops and the servers and the routers and the switches and firewalls and all that stuff, right? But assets are so much larger than that, right? Assets are the data that you have, right? The intellectual property. It is your customer list. It is the administrators that have access to different systems, right? It is the databases. It's all of that stuff. So assets is much larger than just what we typically think it is. And organizations go, man, I got compromised. I don't know how I got compromised. And then you go look at the organization, and they have an organization of 100 people, and 80 of them have administrative rights. It was only a matter of time. Right, so you sort of scale that thinking when it comes to asset management. The second thing I tell people, and this is whether you're at work, whether you're work from home, whether you're on your personal systems, right? Update and patch your systems, right? How many times do you get that annoying little thing on your Android smartphone that says, "Hey, you got to restart now"? How many people ignore it?
Oh,
lots,
yeah.
Right? Update right. Your stuff, right? Don't skip Patch Tuesday, right? Do all of those kinds of things, right? That's a basic, right? Similarly. Update your antivirus signatures, right? If you are running, you know, pick an antivirus capability, right? If you're not updating that, you're just asking for trouble, right? So make sure that you're continually updating. Don't turn that off. Yeah, those alerts are annoying, but if you turn it off, you're going to potentially be exposed. Next one, basics. Use really strong passwords, right? But better yet, turn on multi-factor authentication, right? Many services out there, Google, Microsoft, et cetera, right? If that's where you get your email from, for example, right, turn on multi-factor authentication, right? There's so many ways to get that done and make it easy today. Even you like your access to systems remotely, right, with your work and stuff like that, make sure multi-factor authentication is turned on. That'll stop 99% of, you know, password attacks, right? Because once they hit that block and they go, oh, man, multi-factor is turned on, well, I'm just going to move on to the next thing. Right, because it's hard to get through two things of authentication versus just one. The next one I tell people is use a VPN. Right, if hopefully you're not wandering about the universe over the next few weeks, right? But if you are on public Wi-Fi, airport, Starbucks, whatever, right? Make sure you use a VPN. Right, protect yourself and your potentially if you're doing work stuff, your employer and stuff like that, right? Same kind of thing, right? You probably want to use a VPN at your house as well, right? Make it hard for the attacker to get after you, right? I have my last two notes. Don't click on, and I said in parentheses, expletive of your choice, right? Don't click on stuff, right? That's the worst thing you can do, right? Validate stuff, right? And I always tell people, if it feels weird, if it looks weird, if you and your gut think that this is a bad thing, don't click on it, right? Trust your gut in this kind of thing, right? Use that good part of human nature to protect yourself, right? And probably to summarize all of that stuff, Ravi, I would say make yourself a hard target, right? The more of these kinds of controls that you put in place, whether it's personally or professionally or work from home or whatever, the more types of things that you can do there to make it hard for the threat actors to get after you, to get access to your stuff, the more likely they are, and this is sad and sounds kind of sad, the more likely they are to move on to the next soft target, right, who didn't do the things that you did, right? Let's not make it easy for the threat actors. Let's make it hard for them.
Exactly. Brad, I got to sneak just one last question. I'm sorry about this.
Sure.
You talked about multi-factor authentication. I originally started my business doing writing for biometric technology, you know, which is the fingerprint recognition and hand scanning. So for, have you done any work with biometrics, and what do you think the use of, like, facial recognition, iris, and fingerprint recognition as a multi-factor authentication? Just briefly, what do you think about that?
I'm not sure I like iris stuff. I dealt with iris stuff, probably 10, 15 years ago now, right? And the technology had not matured, and I don't think it's as mature now. Facial recognition is is good, but in many cases, right, you can use a picture potentially to spoof that and get past facial recognition, right? So I think biometrics, you know, from an authentication perspective, something you are, right, has a ways to go. I don't think, and I've not seen, you know, really that broad adoption. I mean, I think you see more fingerprint stuff now with phones and with laptops and stuff like that, and I think that's pretty well good from a local access perspective. But at an enterprise level, right, rolling that out large scale, it's going to take some time, right? I think the technology, in my opinion, has a bit more time to mature. And I know there's a lot of great organizations out there that are working on that. But again, it's one of those things that until you can get to the point where it's working accurately, and you're not seeing a lot of false positives or seeing a lot of spoofing, I don't think you'll see necessarily the broad adoption that could certainly help to secure ourselves.
Okay. Well, Brad, we thank you for your time this afternoon. We hope to have you again on another podcast in the future here. Hopefully, when we talk next time, this coronavirus thing, hopefully will start to kind of dissipate back into the clouds, and we'll have some happier times ahead of us. So, yeah, thanks again for your time. We really appreciate it.
You are most welcome, sir. Yes, sir.
Take care. Have a great rest of the day.
Yep, you too.